All right, folks, we are back on the Flagstick.com Tee Talk podcast, and this episode is brought to you by TaylorMade and the all-new SimMax and SimMax OS Irons. Stefan Tiedorf here, and I'm sitting in a nice studio Zoom with my co-host, Scott McLeod. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right, man, doing all right. Looking forward to a lot of golf talk.
Yeah, and we got some good news, potentially. If I've speculated on this podcast, July is the first time we'll be golfing in Ontario, and boy, does it look like I'm wrong, hopefully. This, you know, anything could happen with what's going on in the world right now, but it's looking like May is even a possibility in Ontario. The Doug Ford announced, you know, go out and start preparing golf courses as if they hadn't already. Like, they're all looking unbelievable. You saw the pictures of Smuggler's Glen recently, I assume, on Twitter. It looks like it just wants a big old divot out of those fairways. But they're ready. All these golf courses are ready. And hopefully within the next couple days or hopefully in the next week, we hear when they actually can open and start operations and getting players out on the course.
Yeah, we're starting to get obviously some activity on golf courses around the country. British Columbia, Alberta, PEI, New Brunswick, Yukon, Manitoba, they're all getting ready. They've already playing already, and then ranges are opening in Nova Scotia, and Newfoundland will be ramping up May 11th and Saskatchewan May 15th, and then we'll see what's going to happen for Ontario and Quebec. Quebec, they can open the pro shops right now. They can just take in people just from a retail basis. And like you said, we should hear. We've heard some sort of hints from Premier Doug Ford of Ontario that you know, golf courses obviously have to, you know, start getting ready. So that's the sign that you know, we're going to be able to take some divots, as you said, in the next probably in the next couple of weeks. So a positive sign, obviously cautionary as well. I mean, everybody's got to deal with certainly a lot of different new procedures and things like that. But in any case, golfers will be happy, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. Since I kind of was getting this, you know, I heard last week, you know, start operations, yada, yada, yada. So went out on the weekend with my shag bag and pitching wedge, found a school with a big soccer field and was just hitting some pitching wedges, feeling good, taking out some dirt. I mean, I'm ready for, you know, well-maintained grass and not hitting off half grass, half gravel, half sand, but It felt great just to hit the ball. It was the first time in I don't know how long, 2 months, 2.5 months since I saw a golf ball in the air. It was nice to see. Have you gone out and done any chipping or hitting balls anywhere yet?
Yeah, just chipping in the yard, you know, while you're out barbecuing and stuff. It was pretty nice on the weekend. So, you know, got a few balls out there and just chipping back and forth. And I'd stay pretty active in talking with students and stuff. So I've been doing lots of, you know, little putting stuff and things inside, but it's not a substitute for being out on grass and, you know, that feel that, you know, that wedge working its way through the turf and seeing that, you know, nice contact with the ball and seeing that ball fly in the air. So I'm looking forward to it as well.
Yeah, I think I believe you had a tweet on your teaching account or your personal account, basically talking about not worrying about scores right now. Mm-hmm. I was listening to, you know, Ray Ferraro was on a you know, from TSN was on a podcast, was talking about he was able to play golf this week. And, you know, he said he doubled the first three holes and a smile on his face the whole time. Cause who cares at this point? Once you go out, I think a lot of us will be in that same mindset of just, hey, it's golf at this point. I'm outside. I'm with friends that I don't even get to really spend time with really because of what's going on. And I was joking with my buddies, maybe you'll actually come out and play golf this year because there's nothing else. If you've been locked inside with your wives, you have no reason not to come out and play now. You can't be locked in anymore. They're gonna have to let you out of jail. The warden's gonna have to give you a day pass or something here soon. So hopefully you get to play soon. Pebble Beach has recently opened back up. I saw they made an announcement, and I think this is kind of where I could see a lot of golf courses going. You know, no club rentals, the driving range being open, but, you know, some big gaps in between people, you know, things like, you know, no caddies. You know, if you're taking a cart, you got to be in your own cart or, you know, somebody from your house, things along those lines. You know, on the course, you know, the cups will have something in it, so make sure the ball stays on top. And, you know, food carts really won't be out there. If they are, they'll be very minimal, no contact, things along those lines, which, you know, it's fine. I think these are the small changes, you know, restrooms. This is the thing I like, that the restrooms will be one person only and will be sanitized regularly. It was like, huh, so what were you doing prior to this? Like, you're just leaving it, which, like, we've all been to those golf courses where that restroom hasn't seen somebody in it in 4 or 5 days to clean it. So these are the small things that, you know, small changes. I don't think anyone will really care that much once you actually get out there.
Yeah, they shouldn't. I mean, they should just be happy to be out there. Like you mentioned, you know, I was tweeting about a friend, you know, sort of talking about worrying about his score and stuff when he gets out there. I'm like, just go and enjoy it. And, you know, I was on a call today with a number of PGA members, our zone, a discussion, and everybody was talking a little bit about what they're going to be doing, you know, going forward, and what, you know, tee times are implementing, how much space they're putting in. I mean, we're hearing a lot of this stuff. We're seeing a lot of the things happening. And I think what we just have to do is we have to, you know, have to keep it in context and realize that, you know, just be happy to be out there, and whatever the situation is, just respect it. You know, otherwise, you know, this could go away from us. So just be happy that you're able to get out there. If you do, you know, respect whatever procedures are put into place by the golf courses, and just enjoy it for what it is, and don't worry so much about a score. Just, you know, fellowship of other golfers and the chance to be out there breathing fresh air and hitting a golf ball in the air.
I can't wait. I don't even know where I was going with my first sentence. I just can't wait. That's the key.
Everybody's pretty excited. I mean, I've talked to a lot of golfers in the last little while, and I think you're right. I mean, they're already pent up with excitement in the springtime in Canada as it is. And usually that's, you know, earlier in the year. This just means they've had more time to think about it, more time to dream. You know, lots more people obviously hitting golf balls in their backyard, you know, chipping, putting, pitching. They've got a little bit more spare time, so they're getting revved up even more. And as you said, getting all these pictures of all these great golf courses now starting to be better maintained by, you know, a larger number of staff. They're getting these pictures posted up on their social media. These golf courses are, and the courses look great. And, you know, certainly kudos to the staff that have been able to do that so far and get that work in there. And I know golfers hopefully will be respectful of those layouts when they get out there.
Absolutely. And yeah, I saw some silly videos of people acting like idiots where you are able to play. Like, if your cup is turned upside down and you just have to hit the cup to make your putt for now, don't ruin it for the rest of us. Like, just hit the cup and move on. But let's move on ourselves, because, you know, I'm excited to play golf. I don't know how excited I am about this next thing, but live golf is coming back. Rory McIlroy, Dustin Johnson, Ricky Fowler, and Matthew Wolff are going to be headlining TaylorMade's Driving Relief, which is a televised golf event for, you know, COVID-19 relief efforts. I think the four guys are great. You know, all team TaylorMade guys. And I just don't know what's it going to be like. Is it going to be Mickey Mouse? I'll give you this. I'm much rather watch this than this whole Tom Brady, Peyton Manning, Tiger
the match thing.
Yeah, the match two. Because I think these guys will rib each other. They're younger. And, you know, Rory doesn't hold back regardless of you know, whether he's mic'd up or not. You know what? Maybe I'm turning a leaf. I think I'm going to watch it, obviously. But what are your thoughts on this?
I think the ratings are going to be through the roof because everybody's eager to watch some live sports. They're one of the first sports that's obviously going to be back. I think the other big treat here is the fact that the venue is Seminole Golf Club. This has not been, they've not hosted televised events. Everybody knows this, you know, iconic private golf club down in South Florida where Ben Hogan liked to practice. Beautiful spot along the ocean. They are having a Walker Cup coming up. So this kind of gives the, you know, the television group a chance to practice a little bit for when the Walker Cup comes there. But I think that's the cool treat as well, is the fact that they're playing this golf course. And I think, you know, we're going to see equal amount of people watching it for the golf as the golf course. It's been interesting so far to, you know, with the pairings the way they are, and just seeing people talking about, you know, who's going to win or whatever. I mean, does it really matter? Probably doesn't. I mean, in the end, you know, there's $3 million that's heading to charity, at least another million that's up in their birdies to an Eagles pool. And then on top of that as well, there's going to be a text to donate platform available too. So if people want to give, you know, to the causes and based on watching this, then, you know, that's open as well. So, you know what, raising some good money for COVID-19 relief efforts, the chance to see four top players and a great golf course and, you know what, live sports. So we'll take it. I'm not going to complain, and you shouldn't either.
Yeah, that's fair. You got me turned around, and you know who was going to be most excited? Those degenerate gamblers that haven't had anything to gamble on sports wise for the last while. I'm sure there's going to be all sorts of bets you can place on these guys at some point. So if that's your thing, you know, gambling on sports, then you're back too. You're probably just as excited as everyone else.
Yeah, definitely. You know, the odds are showing in the favor of McElroy and Johnson. They're 1-2 versus Fowler and Wolf at 2-3. I did get a whole bunch of the prop bets. I apologize for not having those handy because I didn't think we'd be talking about it that much, but certainly there are a ton of prop bets. And I mean, they go down to rate to, you know, what color hats they're wearing. There's really a ton of prop bets that are available.
And as you said,
it sort of showed me right away that, you know, obviously the bookies are a little, you know, desperate for some action as well. So that's why there's so many different options to bet on. But certainly it'll be interesting, I think. And I mean, I put out a poll this week, you know, right after it was announced. And I think we came in almost 90%. I think it was 88 or 89% of the people thought that Johnson and McElroy will be the winner. So we'll see how that plays out. What are your thoughts on that one?
Yeah, in terms of winners, I think of the four of them, I bet you Matt Wolf is probably doing the most practicing. He's a young, you know, hungry guy. The other three are established. I think DJ literally posted on his Instagram that he just hit a golf ball today for the first time in 2 months, which we joked about earlier. We kind of saw that coming. So, yeah, Rory and DJ should take it ideally, but at the end of the day, it's golf and all these guys could beat each other on any given day. So who knows? And at this point, who knows how much practice each guy's done. So it's going to play a big part at the end of the day. He said it's just something to watch on TV, some golf, and it's a good thing, clearly, where all the money's going. And we're getting closer to the return of the PGA Tour, this means as well. If they're able to do this, then it's kind of a test for those things. And as we've talked about in the past, the PGA Tour will be returning. And I was reading a lot of speculation on the PGA Tour returning. Obviously, it's going to come with no spectators. And how many golf balls are they going to lose? And yeah, they're probably going to lose some golf balls. It doesn't really matter. But they're speculating that they're going to come back with no caddies. And I'm giving that a 1% chance they come back with no caddies. I just do not see that happening. I talked to a couple of them, and they haven't heard anything about not coming back with caddies. What are you hearing? What are your thoughts? Because I just don't see it happening.
Yeah, I heard those same rumors too. I haven't heard anything from the inside on that one. I mean, here's the situation. I mean, we've already got a fair number of people involved anyways. So I'm not sure that, you know, adding one more person in there is probably, you know, making that much more of a, you know, difficulty. Of course, they're going to come back with certain regulations, no different than this event. You know, they said for the event in Florida, the Skins game, that, you know, they have obviously got to follow all the regulations that's happening, all the testing and things like that. So, you know, whether it's a player being tested or a caddy being tested, I don't really think that's that much of a difference that way. It's sort of integral to the tour. And it kind of plays into actually a question that we have in our mailbag a little bit later on that we'll deal with. But I don't see the PGA Tour coming back with no caddies. I mean, you know, weirder things could happen. You never know. I don't see them being out there with push carts, pushing them around or carry bags or whatever. Funny, but we'll see, I guess.
Who of all the players on the tour, if they had to come back, no caddies, and they have to come back with push carts, who's the player that comes back with the electronic push cart?
Again, this plays into our mailbag question later, really, which I can, you know, we'll talk.
All right, actually, why don't we just leave it. Let's leave it then.
Yeah, So, it would be interesting. That's a little bit of a variation on what the question is, but let me think about that one.
We call that a tease in the biz.
Sure.
Well, that's cool. We'll get to the mailbag in a bit. Now, there are other stories coming out of the other golf tours going on. The Korn Ferry Tour announced their restart schedule. You know, you're the guy that gets all the paperwork, and you know, you explain it to me like I'm five usually, and I nod and pretend I understand. But here's your chance. What's going on with the Korn Ferry Tour when they come back?
Yeah, when we had Scott Pritchard on from the Mackenzie Tour last week, obviously he made indications that, you know, they were waiting on their tour for what was going to happen on the Korn Ferry Tour, which is kind of, you know, above them. And their tour, the Mackenzie Tour, plays into that tour. So they have to wait to see what they were doing. So the Korn Ferry Tour basically announced that, their restart schedule. They will start in Jacksonville, but what they're going to do, and that's going to be in the first week of June, it'll be the same time as the PGA Tour is starting. They had already completed 6 events for the season. They'll now have a schedule that's 23 events, but what they're going to do is they're going to overlap and combine the two seasons. So 2020 and 2021 will be combined. So basically what you're going to find is that there's not going to be a graduating class for 2020 from the Korn Ferry Tour. They will have the top 10 players will have some access to the 2020 and the 2021 PGA Tour. But in essence, the really cards that they're chasing are going to be at the end of 2021. And that's when they'll do their usual graduation of the 25 and 25. So what it does is it's going to free up some players, and that'll be interesting to see is, you know what, they don't have anything really on the line so much. I mean, they still have access to get to the PGA Tour, but they can freewheel a little bit more knowing that they have all of next season as well. And, you know, that's something we had talked about as far as the players and their cards and how they're going to retain their cards. Now we know from a Korn Ferry perspective, these guys that qualified for this year are still going to have full access through next year. They've got time to not, you know, panic, and they can just kind of freewheel a little bit.
Yeah, and I was thinking, like, is this a good thing? Is it a bad thing? I think in that respect, yes, it's a good thing. I think the players at the top, it's like I'm playing so well right now. I've played that full, what would be our normal full year, and I'm at the top. And at this point, I should be on the PGA Tour. So there is that give and take. Yeah. At the end of the day, we talked with Scott, like, there's no book for this of how the proper way. And we may look back and have revisionist history on this and say, that wasn't the best idea, or that was actually the perfect situation. I'm going to assume the trickle-down effect means the Canadian Tour will look something similar, because if, you know, these guys aren't graduating, well, there really isn't spots for the guys from the Canadian Tour to graduate into the web.com. Any other information coming out of any of the other golf tours going around?
Well, the other one that's, you know, really being discussed heavily right now is what's going to happen at the European Tour. I mean, there's indications that, you know, because of the nature of their tour being a little bit more, even more international, and where their events are around the world, that they were looking at possibly a restart even later, possibly as late as September. And as a result of it, there's some, a lot of speculation about the future of that tour. And Global Golf Post had an issue came out today that had an extensive amount of stories talking about the possible integration of the European Tour within the PGA Tour. This has been talked about a little bit before, you know, basically saying, you know, would it be good to have that tour as part of it? You got to think the PGA Tour wants to really own all the Ryder Cup.
They would love
that's
that.
The cash cow for the European Tour. So, and if the European Tour is in trouble obviously they need their sponsors, they need to be run their events. And if they can't do that and they don't have, maybe have their players, because maybe a lot of those players are going to end up over on the US side of it, then I think it's reasonable to think that, you know, there's definitely some meat to this.
Yeah. I mean, I love the European Tour. We've talked about it. You know, one of the weirdest things I miss about normalcy is waking up on a Saturday morning and early, you know, 7 o'clock, and just watching some European Tour golf of guys I've never really heard of on a course I'll never see in my life. I miss that, but can you imagine if the PGA Tour just owned it all, right? And maybe, yeah, there's, well, like,
the thing is,
PGA
the thing
Tour
is with
Europe
this is
and
it doesn't mean the European Tour is going to go away.
Yeah.
What it means, though, is that could be just under the PGA Tour umbrella. Yeah. So you'll still be able to wake up and watch it over there. But, yeah, you know, we end up with a bigger monopoly. And, you know, as you said, it could be good or it could be bad.
Well, there
because
could be a different
the European
status
Tour
thing,
has
right?
a certain flavor to it, right?
Like, there could be a different status, right? Say you got it and maybe you don't lose your card. Now you're on the, like, maybe it's another step. Maybe you go from the Canadian Tour to the Korn Ferry Tour, and then you graduate to PGA Tour Europe, and then you graduate from there to the PGA Tour. You can go back and forth. Like, who knows? Again, I actually don't necessarily wish that at all. It's just content, because we love the European Tour. We love the guys out on there. And you know, as we've talked about, their social media team, it's almost impossible to beat at this point. They come out with the greatest content. So I'm not saying that we wish this by any stretch of the imagination. It's literally, I just think it could be a really cool situation if it does happen. And yes, there is the logistics right now of a European tour would be really, really, really hard, right? You're talking about going from country to country when we're really trying to lock people into one country right now. Like I was talking to my buddies about, you know, a golf trip. Like, do you see yourself traveling outside of Canada this year? Cause I don't know if I, like, you know, I don't see myself hopping on an airplane until maybe 2022 at this rate. So like the fact that they're trying to do this type of stuff. Yeah. It's financially really hard, but also just logistically, you know, it's much easier to keep some people contained, at least within one country, than, you know, flying all over and different regulations everywhere. So, I don't know where I'm going with this at this point, but the point is, I think some cool could come out of this, but I do hope everyone at the European Tour is taken care of, and that's the key. And it's unfortunate to see that, but who knows, maybe some positives do come out of all of that.
Yeah. I think in the end here is, you know, it will only happen if they're forced into it. Obviously, if there's a situation that's so dire that they need to, and really, you know, as you said, we don't want it to lose its identity. It's got a spot in the world as far as the tour is concerned. But obviously if we have a choice of it surviving or not surviving, we'd like to see it survive in some way, whoever's backing it. And, you know, we'll see how that plays out as this whole situation plays out.
I like it. I think, I don't know if you saw this on social media lately, but FootJoy has been doing a cool bracket thing. A lot of companies are doing kind of brackets of their best products. We've been talking, you know, our favorite irons of this brand, our favorite putters of all time. And FootJoy did this. They're doing basically a bracket of their top shoe of all time, which is, it's really cool. FootJoy is that classic shoe that everyone, you know, when you think of golf, it's one of the top 3, 4, 5 brands you're thinking of in the shoe department. You know, that'd just be fun to not necessarily go through the bracket per se of,
yeah,
but rather just name our top four based on the 16. So, you had a chance to look at this?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I thought it was interesting. Like you said, so many brackets are out there, whether it's contests of, you know, logos or courses or things like that. And, you know, it was smart of them to jump on it, given the heritage of the company and how they go back so far. You know, basically before the company was actually called FootJoy, it goes back to the mid 1850s, which leads its way into one of the shoes, which was one of my favorites, which is the 1857 Shield Tip, which is a shoe they brought out 2 years ago to sort of pay homage to their very traditional leather welt shoes that they used to make in their classics plant in Brockton, Mass. And it's kind of neat just to go through. And I mean, obviously the opinions will vary a lot depending on what your preference is for style. If you like the classic stuff, the younger stuff, you know, some of us are a little older and might have went to the original plant and, you know, and I won't say not the 1857 plant, thankfully, but, you know, as far as the FootJoy original plant and just going there and seeing how those shoes and things were made sort of gives you a little bit of an emotional tie to some of the classic stuff that you used to see. So, I'll start off with that one, the 1857 Shield Tip, which was a shoe, highly priced shoe, goes for about $750 US, but man, talk about quality as far as the shoe is concerned. Limited quantities, really certainly for the discerning individual, really wanting the most classic handmade type shoe of all time. So I'll start with my list right there.
$750. Now, if you do look at it, it's classic. Like it's got that almost, you know, it looks like wood in the heel.
Wood.
Like it's nice. I don't know if it's $750 nice, but hey, you know, if you got it, why not? My first one I'm going to pick here is just kind of the original classic saddle shoe in white. My key here is the white. Just again, I think it's a little bit newer style than what you're talking about, those 1857 Shield Tips, but they're just a classic shoe. You know, Justin Thomas uses a lot of those kind of classic shoes. And that's one for me that, you know, if I'm going that classic look, that's the style I'm going for.
Yeah, it's really iconic. And, you know, thinking back to that factory as well, I mean, they had a lot of longtime employees that worked at that factory, a lot of stuff that was done handmade. And I can remember going there for the first time in about 1993, and they introduced me to an old Italian gentleman who had to be probably in his 80s at that point. And he had actually invented their machine that they used to put in metal spikes. And, you know, previous to that, they've been doing it by hand. And so he had built this machine that would put in, I think it was 5,000 spikes a day or whatever, but it was in those classic shoes. So I certainly can't knock you for picking that out. And, you know, if you're going to do it, obviously the all white, which is, you know, they call it a classic for a reason.
Absolutely.
Right?
So you talked about doing that by hand. You and I both have the distinction of working in golf shops for a lot of our lives. And that might be the worst job, is doing spikes.
Changing spikes.
Not necessarily the putting them in. They're usually pretty quick. You click it in and away you go. It's the taking them out. And there was always the guy, the old guy with, like, these shoes should have been burnt. Not even like brought into the store. You ever watch The Office where he goes to get his shoes cleaned and he leaves them outside his door and they don't bring anything back because they burnt them because it was as a hazard? Like, we've all done those types. But then you can't actually get the spike remover tool, so you have to get the ripper to get it out. And even sometimes that didn't work. I remember burning some out and be like, hey, like, you got 4 spikes on this shoe. Deal with it. So don't be that guy. Just buy some new shoes every once in a while. But they're
yeah, I can remember actually getting a drill out and having to drill out.
Oh, yeah, the drill hole. And
like, seriously, you know, they'd come in. And the funny part was, too, I remember you do it, whatever the price was. Let's say in my day, we can do it. Oh, it was 50 cents a spike or whatever like that. Not knowing how much labor it was going to take to do these shoes. And of course they'd be like, hey, can I come back in an hour? And like an hour later they come back and you've got 1 spike out. That's it. Yeah. That's all you've managed to do, because these things are concrete. They've been in there, they've had these shoes for 40 years, and they're part of the shoe now, locked in. All right, I'll move on to my next one. I'm going to take the Dry Joys Tour, which is kind of a crossover shoe in the fact that it combines sort of that classic saddle look, but then marries it to sort of a more modern sole. And I might have a pair or two of these in my repertoire, and you know, have a little bit more comfort than the classic saddle, just because they have a little bit more cushioning to them on the sole, but still have that nice look. Again, really classic, which is what a lot of people have gone away from in a lot of years. You see a lot of athletic shoes in the last bunch of years, and you certainly don't see a lot of the classics. But, you know, when people pull them out and wear them, they certainly give you some feelings of, you know, just what golf used to be.
Yeah, I definitely have a pair of Dry Joys Tours. I've had them they're my, you know, my spring and fall shoe where it's mucky because I know they're not getting wet. That's for sure. These things are going to... Like when the world's over, these things are still going to be around. But yeah, they're a classic for sure. I'm going down a different road. So I went down the classic saddle from the top 16. And now I'm going to the DNA. I think it's a kind of a classic look, but also new school at the same time. And the DNA with the white again, I'm a white shoe guy. Gotcha. You'll catch that. I mean, I'm going to go in a different direction eventually, but I'm a white shoe guy just from, I have a weird thing with shorts. If you're wearing shorts and dark shoes, I don't know what it is. It just doesn't look good to me. Just on the golf course. And the DNAs, I remember the first time I put on the original DNA, how light it was and how comfortable it was. And I had to have them and I loved them. And unfortunately, I think I lost them at a golf course. I left them on top of the car or something like that. Never saw them again, but these are comfortable. The DNA 2.0 after that was, you know, just as comfortable. Great, great shoe. Pricey as well, but a great shoe, and kind of where the FootJoy's going kind of with their designs, where they're trying to keep that classic look and, but also adding a little bit of an athletic flair to it.
Yeah. And, you know, if we blend over, you're right. I mean, that shoe was super comfortable. A lot of people really liked it. It was a different direction for them, but still kind of maintain a little bit of a touch with some of their older stuff. So, you know what, I'm going to flip. I had one I was going to have here talk about for my third one, but I'll talk about my fourth one first, because it really is on that same vein, which is a modern one that just came out, the Tour X, which really has the kind of a combination of two things. It has a really stable platform. You know, it's really targeted for those tour players, but it still has a little bit of an athletic feel to it. It's not so much super, you know, classic. It doesn't look like something that you're going to show up at a wedding with, which I guarantee you there's probably a million people that are listening to this podcast. Maybe not a million, but a lot of people are listening to this podcast that have probably worn golf shoes at some point to a wedding or some sort of event, just because they look, you know, hey, they look like a dress shoe, right?
Well, they came out with one last year. I'm forgetting the name. And I remember you and I said that. I was like, man, those are just really nice. They're a soft spike shoe. They came, I remember them being in this like nice blue color. I'm drawing a blank on the name, and boy, were those like, you could easily wear those to a wedding. If I knew that, if it came out a year prior, I had a nice blue suit on at my wedding. Why couldn't we have worn golf shoes, right?
Yeah, why not? Yeah, so that's my third one. I'll go with the Tour X.
Yeah, so the Tour X, just looking at it, it kind of looks like a hybrid between the DNA and the Pro SL. And the Pro SL is my next one, the soft spike. It's got that kind of wider look to it. Very flat, easy walking shoe. You see guys like Lee Westwood, Corey Connors, you know, always is wearing those as well. I haven't had a chance to buy a pair of Pro SLs yet, but they've always been on my list of shoes to buy. Though if I think if I buy another pair, I might be living with my shoes next. But I think the Pro SLs are just a really good walking shoe. I found a lot of guys with sore backs fitting into them really well. I don't know why. Could just be making this up, but you know, I think it's a classic new school look of just kind of that flat kind of, you know, you could walk into the pro shop with it. You could go to the bar after. They're very soft spikes, and you know, they're not going to hurt your feet if you got to stop at the grocery store after. Why not? They're not that weird to look at. So yeah, I think there's another kind of, you know, modern shoe.
All right. So I'm going to end with my fourth one. It's probably the most modern shoe for me from an athletic standpoint. I love the flexes. And I remember you got to wear a pair while you were caddying at the Canadian Open. They had a special edition that they created, the red and white ones. And I've been loving these shoes. I've got a limited edition pair as well. And they've been coming out with some limited edition versions. And one of the pairs that they came out with in 2019 was when the PGA Championship was at Bethpage Black. And they came out with this blacked out edition of the Flex Blackout. Kind of a cool shoe, totally, obviously black sole, black midsole, black upper, has that Flex shoe, super comfortable, has the warning, the Bethpage Black, as far as the difficult golf course warning label sort of on the heel. Just a cool shoe, something different, very limited. And I think it was super popular when it came out for a number of reasons. And I like the shoe. I like the look. The combination of the two makes it a winner for me.
Yeah, those shoes were so comfy, and shout out to FootJoy for hooking up all the caddies last year, the Canadian Tour, with those. I'll tell you this, they're not waterproof, as I learned very quickly, stepping into a puddle on my first day, but very, very comfortable, and a shoe that I still wear all the time golfing. The white and red, check them out. Great shoe, nice and light too. They're like, in a hot day, go with them. You know, you're not getting that moisture, that sweat in the shoe. They're just that light. I'm going to end on a real weird one. And this is coming in as the 15th ranked shoe in their entire program. And I don't think it's getting through the first round against the Icon Shield Tip, but it is the Freestyle, the Frog shoe. And it's got like the green and the blue and the orange, and the yellow and the white. And oh, it's a shoe that only a mother could love, or whatever that saying is. You know what I mean? Like, it's not, a lot of people think it's ugly. I love it. I had a pair of these as well. They're fun. They're light. They don't match much, but who cares? You know, as you can tell, I kind of like to go in that different kind of fashion if I can with golf clothing, and the Freestyles were one. When they first came out, I was like, oh, those are so ugly. I need them. And I picked them up right away. I wonder what happened to those ones. I miss those shoes. I might have to pick up another pair at some point on eBay. I bet you could probably get some for pretty cheap out on eBay.
Yeah, they're a super comfortable shoe, and that's obviously the color that they came out with first, and you know, they sent them out from the media to look at, and they sent it in this box with a little plastic frog in it as well, which obviously they took the colors from that frog and thought about the comfort and the mobility of their feet, and that was sort of the inspiration for the shoe. And I've got a pair as well, and I've got them in those colors, and I actually had thought about later on getting the, you know, the blue ones or the black ones or something like that, but I'm the same as you. You know, they don't match with a lot, but they're a really distinctive shoe, and they're super comfortable. They're not from everybody, because they are a little bit more of a mobile shoe, not a, what we'd call a stable shoe. But they feel great when you're walking in them, and you know, in the summertime, you know, just throw those on, single strap bag over your shoulder and away you go.
Yeah, I missed them. My dad had a pair of the black and red ones, and you know, his buddies always tripped them for him, but he always said one of the most comfortable shoes he ever had, and that just kind of also shows to where we're at. Like we've said that about, you know, we mentioned eight and maybe yeah. outside of the ones that are built in 1857, we all, you know, they're super comfortable and durable, and FootJoy just makes a great shoe. So shout out to FootJoy in the bracket. Check it out on their social media, on Instagram at FootJoy, or their Canadian page at FootJoy_CA, I believe. But we do have an interview this week. We've been talking for a while. Why don't we give somebody else a chance to chat with another Flagstick, staffer, you could say. Who do we got this week, Scotty?
Yeah, he's a contributor for us. Chris Stevenson, everybody knows him as CJ Stevenson, longtime sports writer for the Ottawa Sun, and then transitioned as well over to working for The Athletic, an analyst for TSN 1200. He's a Golf Journalists Association of Canada member, covered lots of golf through his career. Basically, hockey was his main trade, and certainly a wise guy and always fun to talk to. And, you know, this is a guy who portrays his Twitter bio as rinks, links, and drinks. And this is what this guy is all about. And we look forward to always having a conversation with CJ.
This episode of Tee Talk is brought to you by TaylorMade and the all-new SimMax and SimMax OS irons. With an improved speed bridge and echo damping system for better sound and forge-like feel, TaylorMade went further than even they thought possible to create a distance iron that feels better than anyone thought possible. Think about it. How many distance irons can say they have their own sound engineer? In fact, they sound and feel so good, some of the TaylorMade pros thought the irons were forged. The all-new SimMax and SimMax OS irons, designed for distance you can feel. Visit TaylorMadeGolf.ca to learn more about the all-new Sim family.
All right, we want to welcome to the podcast good friend Chris CJ Stevenson, longtime sports writer, currently a contributor to The Athletic, analyst for TSN 1200, hockey guy, but a golf guy too, and a little bit of beer in there as well. Welcome to the podcast, bud.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's nice to talk to some people.
You've been obviously keeping well, but obviously keeping a little bit more at home than usual, right? You're usually on the road
a lot. Yeah, but you know, I'm 62 years old now, Scott, as you know, watching my golf swing. If this is, you know, potentially a glimpse of retirement, 2 or 3 years, maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit less down the road, I could get into it.
Is this the longest maybe that you've not been in a rink in a long while? And you're like a lot of years, decades, probably.
Not really, because, I mean, there were stretches there in maybe up to about 2015, 2016, I'd be on the road for 2 months doing the playoffs. But since my focus shift back to pretty much doing the Senators, we know how they've been and when their season has ended. So the last 2-3 years I've been kind of used to, you know, flipping into a closer to home mode come April. So this really, to tell you the truth, isn't, as far as being at the rink, isn't much different than what the schedule has been for the last couple, 3 years.
Yeah, it doesn't help that the NHL tends to close down operations every 7 years for a lockout here and there, too, that keeps you at home.
Now we're and you know what? I was thinking about that the other day because, you know, thankfully I haven't been engaged in the day-to-day, which I have been before in circumstances like this when the league shuts down. So, you know, I covered
three lockouts,
a strike. Yeah. A strike in the early 90s, lockout 94, lost a whole season, 05 or 04, 05, and lockout in 2012, 13, I think it was. So I know what it's like when not much is going on, and yet you're in there on the daily grind trying to come up with stories every day, right? The you know, whatever medium you're working in, whether it's radio back then for me, print, or online, You know, it's a beast that's got to be fed every day. And as you got into the online stuff, a beast that had to be fed every few hours. And you're constantly working the phones, just trying to come up with some kind of different angle or a little shred of news that you could build a bit of a story on. So I know it's probably been frustrating for some hockey fans listening to, you know, the insiders, my colleagues coming up with stories. And then a couple of days, they seem to contradict each other as the landscape changes. But I know what that's like just working your contracts, trying to find out what's going on, to find out a different spin, find out a different angle. So I've been very sympathetic to those guys on the daily beat through this who have had to try and come up with stories every day.
Well, you're trying to make up stories in, you know, a paused world is really what you're trying to do. And it's impossible to, you know, predict things, but, you know, I guess we'll ask you that. Like, what are you hearing right about now? Do you have any predictions yourself based on, you know, an educated guess at this point of when you see the NHL returning? Do you think it even makes sense to return? What are your personal thoughts?
Well, everything is driven by the dollar, right, for the professional sports. And I think that's why we've seen, you know, the NFL, you know, have their draft the way they did. What are they doing? Is it tonight? They're doing a three-hour show on the schedule? Like, the NFL schedule is coming out. I think they're doing a three-hour,
you know, get 2 million presentation
of the schedule. So, you know, there's no question. There's a huge vacuum out there, Scotty. You know what this is like. There's a huge vacuum out there right now, looking for fresh news in the absence of live sporting events. So, you know, I'm that's what's going to be driving the NHL. That's why the NHL is talking right now about, you know, maybe trying to have the draft in about a month from now in early June. They know that they're going to have the stage to themselves because there won't be much else going on at that point. And that will be an opportunity for them to try and make good on their broadcasting contract, right? I think that's the biggest motivator right now for those guys is how can we cut our losses? Somebody told me the other day that they could lose $1 billion if they don't have the playoffs and award the Stanley Cup. If they do go ahead and play, and it'll probably have to be without fans, people will be like, well, how are you going to make money? Well, at least in that instance, the number I heard was that they would lose $500 million instead of losing $1 billion. So for a $5 billion business, $500 million is a pretty big nut. So I think that's why we're going to be seeing the NHL doing everything they can to try and play. Original question, you know, when might we see something? I think with all the hoops they're going to have to jump through, if players are going to have to come here from Europe, they're going to have to be quarantined for 2 weeks before they can do anything in terms of a training camp or anything like that. The border's still not open in terms of, you know, the U.S. border and American players who play for Canadian teams having to come here and play. So, you know, there's a lot of hoops to be jumped through before they can logistically get this going. So I'm thinking maybe early to mid-July, maybe if everything goes really well, and we'll see how this goes with the reopenings that are going on. If we're going to see a spike in cases again, that's going to completely change everybody's mindset. But I think if things go reasonably well, we could see the players reporting for probably some kind of 2-week training camp, maybe in the latter part of June, and then some kind of resumption of play in July.
Yet when we look back at this, like say they do come back and the season does play, do you actually think we'll even remember the actual season, or will it just be a footnote to everything else that's going on in the world right now? And I'm talking about all sports, right? Like,
right.
We play golf too.
Yeah. I think it is going to be a footnote. I think we'll all remember it, right? This is one of those events that you know, my kids will be telling their kids about at some point. Everybody will be passing along the stories of what it was like in 2020 when everybody had to deal with COVID-19. In the big scheme of things, let's face it, the whole pro sports thing doesn't really matter. And I think we've seen, you know, what's important in life through all of this. And we recognize, you know, how much of a nice add-on to our lives professional sports is, and professional sports are at this point. So I think everybody's looking for a distraction. I think if nothing else, guys, and tell me what you think about this. I just think having professional sports come back in whatever form it takes, whether it's without people in the stands or with social distancing, I think everybody just wants signs that life is returning a little bit to normal. And I think that's one of the things that'll come out of resumption in play, no matter what form it takes, is people will feel like at least we're moving towards whatever the new normal is going to be.
Chris, if my neighbor started a bocce ball league with his kids, I would watch that at this point. Like, I just need some sort of content. So I agree with you 100%. Go ahead, Scotty.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, that normalcy, you know, or some semblance of it is certainly going to be important. And, you know, we transition that even to golf, and we start to think about things that maybe we appreciate a little bit differently. And I think back, Chris, you and I, you know, we were down in Florida playing Winter Park in January, and, you know, it's a very simple, you know, golf course, a whole different situation. It's not the glitz and glamour of a PGA Tour or whatever. And you start to appreciate that, you know, maybe that's, you know, the starting point of things that we really are going to appreciate a little bit more when we come out of this in all the sports that we have, and the fact that how lucky and how fortunate we are in the sporting world. And maybe we just don't appreciate all that we have all the time.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because that was such a great day. And to tell you the truth, it was one of the most fun and memorable days that I've had on a golf course. When we were there for the, we were there in Orlando for the PGA merchandise show. And you were good enough to invite me out on that Friday afternoon at the end of the week to play at Winter Park. And we went out in the morning, and what did we play? A sevensome in the morning and a tensome in the afternoon. And for me, you know, that was just such a cool entry point to a different way of playing the game, right? Everybody's stuck in their you know, foursome play, let's play, stroke play. Everybody puts in a score. Everybody's got a putt out that afternoon in the tensome when we're playing the big skins game. And it's like, if you're not putting for birdie, like, pick it up.
Yeah.
And that's why the play can move along, but it was just such a different dynamic in terms of enjoying golf. And Winter Park itself is such a special place with it being right in the middle of that residential area, and you're crossing the street probably five or six times to get to different holes. Took me back to my my youth when I started playing in Montreal, when played at Grove Hill in Lachine, and used to have to cross the road, cross the street twice, you know, to play holes that were on the other side of the road. That was just such a great experience. And, you know, knowing that I was going to be talking to you today, I was thinking about it, and the shame for me now is like, when are we going to be able to play a sevensome again, or play a tensome again? I guess not until there's a vaccine, and we know that the virus is being controlled that way. But I was thinking about it today, and I was a little bit disappointed, thinking like, yeah, there's not going to be any won't be any sevensomes or tensomes for a while.
I think you touched on a point that I don't think I've actually thought about till right now, is that I think the thing people are missing the most is creating memories, right? And that's what we're talking
for sure
about here.
Yeah.
As heavy as that is to maybe somebody driving their car, tearing up right now, thinking about that, you're not creating a memory. The memory right now is your home in a virus, right? Your memories aren't, you know, going out with my buddies and having a beer at a bar, or going, you know, playing as a sevensome. You're just, nothing is being creative, right? You wake up, you do whatever you can to get through the hours of work, if you're one of the lucky people that are able to work right now, and you go to bed and do it all over again. And I think that's where, you know, opening up these small things like golf will allow those, hopefully those small memories. But as I said, like, we're just not sure when we can create those experiences again. And that's probably the hardest part for everyone. It sounds like a very hard part that you're dealing with right now.
Yeah. And I think like everybody, again, you want those touchstones, you know, those moments or little parts of a routine that tell you that we're getting back to some kind of normalcy again. And I think it's going to be interesting that it looks like golf will be able to play a pretty big part for a lot of people in terms of that happening, which is kind of cool for the game. You know, both on the recreational level, where people will be able to get out and enjoy playing, and also on the pro golf level, because the PGA Tour, what is it? Colonial? It's going to be the first event, like June 8th or 13th, somewhere around there.
Yeah, June 8th to 14th.
Yeah, so we're going to see the PGA Tour actually be, you know, one of the you know, first of our pro sports smorgasbord there that's going to be able to actually get out there and show what the new normal looks like.
Now, you've covered, you know, a lot of golf in your career. You've been lucky to get to a lot of the majors. You know, how's that going to look? I mean, we're going to go back out there to cover it, but it's going to have such a different feel of even, you know, how are you interacting with the players? You know, if there's no fans or if fans, I mean, who knows right now at this point, are they going to allow much media coverage on site?
Yeah, I was thinking exactly that, because, you know, they were, you know, March 12th or whatever it was, when everything started getting shut down, even then they were starting to talk about, you know, the social distancing that was needed in terms of interviewing players, and that dressing rooms weren't going to be open. Like, you know, and there was a pretty good debate going on within the hockey writing fraternity about the impact of rooms not being open, with some people saying, "Ah, we don't really need to get access to the dressing room," and other people saying, "Well, hey, that's, you know, that's really how you build relationships in the game. It's not so much when you go into a dressing room and you've got that formal question to ask. It's when you're in the room and you're talking about what might have happened in another game, just conversation, right? I mean, that's how you build relationships you know, how you wind up having that mutual respect and trust between a journalist and a player is that day to day. And sometimes a player will say something to you you know, they don't want put out there in public, but they think it's important for you to know. And you respect that relationship. And that's, you know, that's the first stone that a relationship's built on, right? And you keep building on it and building on it. So, you know, going forward, if dressing rooms are not going to be open and it's going to be a podium type environment in hockey, say, or Scott, like in golf, if, you know, you're not going to be able to be on the range to be able to be with it, if there's going to have to be, you know, social distancing on the range, and you're not going to be able to just sidle up to a caddy and say, "Hey, what's your man working on?" Or what's in the bag this week? Any changes? All that stuff. And honestly, like our concerns in the big picture of things are not really important at all. But these are things that I've thought about moving forward in terms of doing my job. Is how is the new normal going to affect that ability to build relationships, which I think is the most important thing in a journalist doing their job. And that, you know, cause that gives you the flexibility. Then you get somebody's number, you're able to text them, you can call them. They're comfortable, you know, telling you some things that they might not want completely out in the public domain, but they'll help you out by pointing you in the right direction. So all these things have been going through my mind, because it doesn't sound like anything is going to be close to normal until there's a vaccine. And it doesn't sound like that's going to happen, you know, probably this year. So how is that going to affect us, you know, doing our jobs as far as journalists go?
I think it will separate journalists even more, and the best will continue to be the best because their sources and their those relationship building, that trust will, you know, will already be established, right? And right. It's going to be harder for those new guys to come in and build those sources.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So, like, you know, basically keep supporting those people that, you know, you support because they are the best. And, you know, you're obviously one of those, being that you've been to pretty much everything in terms sporting wise and, you know, all the majors in golf. You've been to a bunch of Olympics. And so say golf does come back, you know, what do you have a plan of how you would cover it for right now? Obviously, you know, are you willing to travel or, you know, does that change
another,
for you?
Yeah, great. Another great question. I was thinking about that today with Air Canada announcing, you know, the new restrictions that they're putting in terms of, you know, temperature checking, everybody having to wear a mask, you know, blocking out middle seats for social distancing.
Not the middle seat. I'm going to miss the middle seat. I don't like, what are we going to do with the middle seat?
They're doing everybody a favor. They're doing everybody a favor with that one.
Everybody's going to turn into a real airline again.
Yeah. So, I almost think the logistics of getting there and the logistics of getting there and then having to be in a hotel for a week and then you're going out to eat every night, like all the things that we've not been able to do and they've been telling us not to do. All the things that we've been told not to do during this whole pandemic are the very things that you're going to have to do to be able to do your job. So
maybe you're the smart guy though, because I mean, I remember a couple of years ago at the Canadian Open, you were camping.
Yes,
as opposed to being in a hotel. And I remember sitting there with you going, man, that's smart because he's real close. I mean, maybe that's the option now, right?
Well, Scott, I will tell you that anytime I am going to cover a golf tournament that I can drive to, camping is always an option.
All right.
I always take a look at that. And I ended up staying down the road from Glen Abbey in Oakville there. It was perfect. I was 10 minutes away from 10 minutes away from the course.
I remember laughing because I had been at my hotel wasn't that far away. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, great, I got a close hotel. And then you show me on a map where you're sitting or where you're staying. And I'm thinking, man, he's out there with a campfire and a beverage.
Yeah.
And
oh, yeah. Oh,
all right. CJ's got it figured out. Veteran.
No, that was a good week. And you're right. Maybe that's the way to go.
Well, I wonder if caddies will start doing that too. Right. And like, you know, we talked, Scott and I, before, and you've obviously caddied a little bit out on the LPGA and on the PGA Tour Canada at times. And, yeah, you know, like, maybe caddies are going to be doing that more, you know, getting the camper van and staying in a, you know, some sort of camper, you know, a van that converts to your home at night just so you're staying away. Because, like, you know, the quickest way to get fired right now as a caddy on the PGA Tour, if you somehow contract the virus and then give it to your player, I think that's an instant fire. Yeah. Right.
I that's a good point, because I think, you know, everybody is going to want to be as much in control of their environment as they can be. Right. And if you, again, got a campsite, or if you've got a van or an RV or whatever, then that does allow you to be really in control of your living circumstances. Anyway, in terms of, you know, what might be going on at hotels, I've heard all kinds of, I've been a frequent traveler for a lot of years, so I've been getting a lot of emails from the reward programs to which I belong, the loyalty programs, you know, telling me what measures they're putting in place for cleaning hotel rooms and everything else. But, you know, when you think about it, it's, you know, some person who you don't know who they've been in contact with coming into your living space. So again, like I said, the logistics of doing the job of covering golf or any professional sport now, or anybody who's got to travel for that matter, have drastically changed. And I think that's going to be the biggest thing to wrestle with. Once you get to the event, it's going to be what it's going to be. You know, if they're going to bring players in and the only access you're going to have is at a is at a podium in a formal press conference situation, then you're just going to have to live with that. And the players that you have numbers for, you can text with them or speak with them on the phone and you know, hopefully live on those relationships. But for me, it's going to be the logistics of doing the job, not for anybody who has to travel.
Well, one thing that might be cool from a golf perspective, right, is that there's not going to be fans. Now, generally speaking, you know, the journalists that go to golf tournaments, you know, I've seen them. They pretty much lock themselves in the journalist, you know, hut or, you know, shed or whatever you want to call it, tent. And they don't leave there. It's like, why do you even have to be on site? Where now it's like,
true,
I don't have to battle the crowds. And there's probably not going to be ropes because I assume there's not going to be a crowd. So let's just have the media have a little bit more access. You might get some more inside scoops, more inside conversations that you're hearing because you're actually able to get closer to the action from this, which will be cool for a short amount of time before they do let the fans back in. But maybe that's a win out of all this, is the stories that are going to potentially come out of this just from the closer to the action access.
Yeah, My golf coverage the last few years has been a little bit different because I've like you guys have said, I've done all the majors and the President's Cup and the Ryder Cup and all that stuff. But the last few years when I've gone to cover golf tournaments, mostly it's been the LPGA Tour and mostly it's been Brooke Henderson. So I've gone out to walk all 72 holes with Brooke Henderson. So I have been a guy who always loved being out on the course. I completely understand why, you know, some of my colleagues stay in the media center when you're trying to cover the whole tournament. There's no better place to be to see what's actually going on than to see it on TV, just because of, you know, the palette that you're faced with being hundreds of acres. And something that could be really important is winds up happening 1500 yards away from you. I understand why they do that, but, for me, there's nothing better in terms of coverage than boots on the ground and eyeballs seeing what's going on. And to your point, if this leads to guys being out there and bringing more color to the game, I think that's what people want now. I don't think it's so much the blow by blow accounts. People want to. I remember Dan Jenkins was he was one of my favorite sports writers growing up, and you know, he cut his teeth covering Ben Hogan. He was the guy who covered Ben Hogan, and I can remember him saying, when it comes to covering any sports story, there's one big moment in any game, and you cannot write enough about it. The whole talent in being a good sports writer is recognizing what that big moment or little moment or a crucial moment, what that moment is. And I think being out on the course and watching and paying attention and listening are the keys to figuring out what that big moment is.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you're not gonna get that from reading a transcript at a press conference. Like you said, it's being out on that golf course, being a foot soldier, seeing maybe what's going on between the player and the caddy, what decisions they're making, especially in the key moments. You know, what they're feeling emotionally, and you can only measure that by being able to watch that. And you're not going to get that by sitting in the media center. Although, like you said, some people are going to be required to do that to do the coverage that they do. I mean, for you, you mentioned covering Brooke Henderson. You know, we've been fortunate enough to have you doing a little bit of that for us as well. And seeing her play, and it's obviously been, you know, one of the biggest stories in Canadian golf. You mentioned sort of those moments. Are there certain ones or certain things? And I know you've mentioned them to me, but maybe you can share them with sort of the listeners, of key things that you've seen the last number of years that really stand out for you of being on that Brooke watch.
I mean, obviously the win in Canada was momentous, right? I mean, that, and just the way she played on that Sunday. And, you know, I'm interested in your opinion on this too, but I've seen her play a lot of golf. She's not the greatest wedge player. And on that last round in Saskatchewan, her wedge play was so good. I was kind of hoping, and the reason why I thought it was so good, and I wrote a piece about this, and I don't know, Flagstick might have even run it, but the thing that stood out for me then was that she found a way not to be swinging her wedge at exactly the same speed all the time that day. It just felt like she had a lot more touch that day, and she took a little off, or she hit something a little bit lower. And I was kind of hoping that maybe that was a breakthrough for her. I can't say that I've been really, really impressed with her wedge play since then. But on that day, I thought that was a huge breakthrough for her. Hey, remember how many times she hit it within 10 feet of the hole with a wedge in her hand, where a lot of times I'd be standing out in the fairway there and I'd be like, this could be like 3 feet from the hole, or it could be 35 feet from the hole.
Yeah, I think you're right on that assessment. I mean, her long game and her swing, you know, as far as her full swing, is never going to basically fail her. But, you know, where she tends to excel is when she can get that short game together. And if she gets that short game together, as you saw and as you mentioned, you know, be it the wedges or her putter as well, I mean, she is almost untouchable. Yeah. And that's what she does. I mean, if she feels it and gets it going, and yeah, we've talked about her putting a lot over the years, and it's the same with those wedges, you know, if she's on with those, then, you know, look out, the rest of them are probably playing for second.
Oh, no question. And I guess two moments that really stand out for me were from 2016 at the KPMG and at Sahali. And that's when she knocked it in from about 100 feet in front of the green on the par five. It was, I want to say it was like the 11th. Knocked it in from like about 100 feet from the front of the green to get within like one or two shots of Ko. And I remember her telling me afterwards that Brittany had told her to aim for this guy. And I can't remember what color the shirt was, but she was like, aim for that guy. So she's over the ball and she's getting ready to aim, and the guy starts to walk. And I just remember, and I just remember Brooke saying, she told me to aim for this guy. And then he started walking away. So she said, I hit the ball and it ends up going in. And, you know, you talk about what golf is going to be like without the crowds and everything else. Like, I just remember, you know, those big pines at Sahali, the big redwoods and the cedars. And she had a big gallery that day. And the noise that went up, it was almost like, you know, what they talk about at the Masters with the sound echoing and everything else. And I remember thinking to myself, whoa, I wonder if Ko can hear that, knows something big has happened in front of her. And then of course she made the putt on 18 to wind up being in the tie. And the other moment that I remember from that was they're going into the playoff and they loaded both of them up into carts. So, you know, Ko and her caddy in one cart with the driver, Brooke and Brittany in another cart with their driver. And they left the 18th green and started driving back down the 18th to go to the tee for the playoff. And it was like the Hunger Games. It was like the crowd was like ringing the hole. It was a par five. It was a par five for the members. They made a par four for the tournament. And them flying down the fairway in these carts with all the people just cheering as they were going back to the tee to start the playoff. That was pretty cool. I still consider that one of the great memories I have of covering sports events.
Well, we've talked about rinks, we've talked about the links, but according to your bio, we also need to talk about some drinks as well. I don't know about you, but this quarantine, I've been going through a lot of beer. What about you? What have you been drinking lately?
I've been wondering, when they talk about COVID-19, is the 19 the number of pounds that we're all going to gain by the time this is over?
Like the freshman 15, right? But we're at 19. I
love trying the craft beers. I've got my go-tos. One of the, you know, and started doing this podcast. We're just kind of dipping our toes into the beer vat as it is at this point. But been talking to, a lot of the craft beer people. And to me, one of the remarkable things to come out of this whole situation is how they've pivoted and managed to sustain their business. And if anything, I think this has been a great opportunity for a bunch of the craft brewers in Ottawa to expose their products to a bunch of people who are sitting around now. And that's what we've been trying to do at the Ottawa Craft Beer and Ciders. I've just been trying to pump out there, be a little bit of a aggregator and a bit of a clearinghouse to let everybody know what's going on with all the different craft breweries, because they've done a fantastic job of, like I said, pivoting and repositioning themselves to make deliveries or have curbside pickups. And, you know, maybe that's going to be out of what I think are going to be a lot of sad stories as far as our economy goes and a lot of businesses. Maybe this will be one of the bright spots, is that a few of these, a few of these local breweries, and everybody here, there's about 12, 13, 14 breweries who just make fantastic beers in Ottawa, that maybe they've had the chance to expose their products to some new customers, and that this is going to be a positive coming out of this for them.
Yeah, I'm currently drinking a Skeleton Park here, a local craft brewery in Kingston, and that was just a delivery. Ordered it one day, and there, a couple of breweries in the area. Like, if you order before three, it'll be on your doorstep by the end of the day. And
done a fantastic job.
I don't want to go back to going to the store.
It's like the milkman of 2020, right?
Yeah, the cool milkman, though, right? The one you actually need to be worried about. You know what I mean? Right, like, he's bringing beer. That's the guy you got to worry about, not the actual milkman, but I'm not going to too much further down there. But I agree with you. I think this is changing business, and that curbside pickup's going to be normal. I was looking at, getting some wood from Home Depot for something. And it was looking at, you can get it cut to your specs. They bring it to the curb, they throw it in the back of your truck, and away you go. Yeah. I don't want to walk through the store anymore. This is amazing. This is business in 2020. This is how we're going to adapt. There's going to be a lot of positive that come out. And yes, as you talked about, there are going to be a lot of small businesses that might not make it through, that just weren't able to adapt. And we're thinking about them as well. But there is some positive. And if I can get beer delivered to my doorstep within hours of ordering it, it's a big positive.
No, it's for me, there's going to be a whole bunch of things that come out of this that are, like I said, are going to be the new normal. And I wonder, I think most people are focusing kind of on the negative at this point, but I think ultimately there are going to be some positives that come out of this. And that's one of the things that stands out for me now is that the craft beer business might have been out of necessity, wound up discovering a new delivery system and a way that makes them even more profitable than they were before. Rather than waiting for people to come to you to give them your product, get out there and give them your product yourself.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think we're seeing all sorts of industries adapting, whether it's, obviously beer delivery. We're seeing a lot more golf teachers being online, lots of different things that way. It's been really, really positive. So
that's and that's what I'm interested too, Scott, from your standpoint as an instructor. I mean, what's that going to look like?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, we had a PGA meeting today, and a lot of people are talking about it. They're obviously wondering what it's going to look like for things like group lessons and junior camps and things like that. Private instruction, you can be away from a person a little bit more. So that's not too bad that way. But people are also realizing within the pro community that there's a lot of other things that they can do to coach golf and be part of golf, and they don't necessarily need to be hands-on to do that. So I've seen a lot more innovations where now coaches are going, okay, you know what? Maybe I need to help out the student with equipment, with fitness, with mentorship and different things. And I can do that through an online program to enhance what we're doing kind of in person as far as a traditional lesson. And then also, being able to analyze their swings and do different things. So it's changing the relationships that pros are having with the golfers. And you're right, it's probably the same thing. It's going to adapt the business a little bit. And what it is, it's getting the people to adapt and realize and understand that they can move forward in different ways. And, they may have been scared to do it before, and now they've been forced into it.
Yeah.
Yep. And as a result of it, they're finding that it works.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the, you know, I think those are the people that are going to come out the strongest at the end of this, whenever that end might be, are those ones that are willing to, you know, instead of looking at the pencil when you're holding it in front of you and you're looking at it from side to side, turning it around and looking at it the other way from end to end, because there's going to be a lot of different ways of looking at things. The people who are the quickest to adapt and recognize those new realities are the ones that are going to get ahead.
Definitely, for sure. Well, we want to thank you for your time. Obviously, you know, an expert on rinks, links, and drinks. Certainly hope to see you on the golf course soon.
Yeah, me too.
We'll see how things play out. But certainly pencil me in, whichever way you look at your pencil, and pencil me in for a game as soon as we can.
I love that. Thank you, Scott.
Watch out for those delivery men, Chris.
I like that. The milkman you have to be wary of.
Awesome.
Thanks, CJ, for that interview. You know, stories for days. We went on for another 20 minutes after that just about hockey stories from back in the day. And, you know, with those old school writers like that, those are the guys. And that's probably what I miss the most, is the stories at a bar right now. We're talking about missing memories and not making memories. Like, I would pay money to meet him downtown Ottawa right now at, you know, Lieutenant's Pump or something like that. When it's like a grimy bar downtown Ottawa, and just post up in a corner and just keep them coming. Let's hear the stories and keep the drinks flowing as well. That's what I miss right now the most.
I might have done that once or twice with him. We've traveled a little bit together. Obviously, he's done some coverage for us for Flagstick.com and Flagstick Magazine as well. So it's always fun just to sit back and listen. And, you know, we're 13 years apart, but obviously he's got a little wider experience outside of, you know, just golf as far as his journalism career. And just to sit back and hear those stories is always fun. And, you know, to do it on a golf course is even better.
I agree. So hopefully that can happen soon. The Last Dance, we've been talking about this podcast a couple times, and got to mention it again, two new episodes just dropped on Monday, and man, they just keep getting better.
Have you crushed through them already? Well, I haven't, so Monday, don't give me too many spoilers.
They come out on Monday and I go through them both. Like, it's like, it's like I usually get up early in the morning, I'll watch one, and then I'll watch another later. I can't. I have to. I have no choice. They're that good. But then I ended up stumbling amongst this doc called Losers on Netflix. Have you heard about this or not?
Yeah, I just caught wind of it, and then you sort of pointed. I didn't realize there was a golf episode, and you pointed that one out to me. And you know what? I watched it right away and absorbed it right up, because it was definitely interesting.
Yeah. So this one's about Jean Vandevelde, who blew it. he lost at Carnoustie in 99, correct? I got the year,
yeah,
right. There
for
we
sure.
go.
Yep.
In 99, and just kind of following the story, it's interviews with him and, you know, the people in his corner and the people that came there and people at his golf club that were watching back home. And just, you know, the idea of the series is just these stories of the people that came in second, right? That didn't win. Because you never hear those stories. And I found it great. What were your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I mean, the story of him, you know, failing going up 18 and then, you know, losing in a playoff, it's been recounted a lot of times, but I think they took a little different angle to it. Not only, obviously, they had him contributing to it, and, you know, you got to give him credit for a guy that's gone through a lot, and, you know, this could have destroyed him. He certainly got the best out of it, certainly had a great attitude about it, and he owned it, really. The fact that, you know, he lost the way he did, and, you know, it's burned in the memory for a lot of golf fans that were around at that time. But I think the neat thing that they did with this was they show that, you know, the fact that even though he lost in the end, there was actually a lot of good that came from it. And I think that's the twist when you sit there and say, oh, it's a documentary, it's called Losers, you know, and you're thinking maybe this is just the story of him losing, and you're thinking, oh, okay, great, you know, whatever. But then they sort of turn it around at the end.
Yeah, I agree with you 100% about the turnaround. And you touched on the part, like, this could only happen to certain people, and it come out in a positive way. And it's, and like he says, you know, really, I don't think about it much, right? Like, people are going to forget about it one day, and they haven't. You know, if you go back to those old interviews.
We're still talking about it 31 years later.
They clearly haven't. But, like, if that happened to me, I'm not handling it well. I'm probably buying, like, at that point in his career, he probably made, you know, close to $1 million or something like that. He had a pretty good year, pretty good couple of years leading up to that. Like, I think if that's happening to me, you're never seeing me again. I'm somewhere in some remote cottage living in the middle of Montana somewhere, Unabomber style. pretty dark that I went with him, of all people. But you know what I mean? Like, I'm not the person that would handle that well, where he clearly is. And he's now teaching golf, and he still plays golf, and he still loves golf, where I feel like so many people would have disdain for golf at that point. My whole thought was, though, like, you know, if everyone's told the story, but like, it's still like, how did the driver even end up in his hands? You know what I mean? Like, how did, like, the caddy, that's the one you only get, I think you get one in your career, the over the knee snap of a club from a caddy. And I think that's the one you missed, you blew it. That was when you snap it over your knee and you go, what's your next choice? Cause you can have anything else, but you're not having this one.
Yeah, definitely. And I think one of the things that I took away from this was the fact that, you know, we talk a lot in golf about, you know, players and up and downs. And, you know, we've talked a lot about various players, you know, ones either you've caddied with or we've covered or things like that. And we began to realize that golf is about being a good loser. I mean, you don't win all the time, and everybody loves a champion. And those are the easy stories to graduate, you know, to kind of gravitate to. But you know what? You got to learn to become a good loser. You don't have to totally be happy with it, but you're going to have to accept it in the end. And the fact that he looked at it from the perspective of, you know, he was a Frenchman getting this, you know, 1999, golf wasn't doing anything in France. I mean, nobody had won the Open from France since 1907. And he realized that there was a positive in the fact that within months of him, you know, doing that, that all of a sudden there was this massive interest in golf in France. And I think if you go and talk to the other players that came after him, and he retired in 2008, that there were players that were inspired by him getting that limelight and being in that position, and that in the end made a difference, and it made him a winner and not a loser.
100%. Great doc though. Check it out. It's about 20 minutes long. And also, if I'm the one telling you about The Last Dance and I'm pitching it, this is the first time you've heard of it. You've been living under a rock somehow in quarantine. I'll give you my Netflix password to go watch this. It's one of the best documentaries. It's got me all fired up. It's great. Go watch The Last Dance. Just go watch it.
This episode of Tee Talk is brought to you by TaylorMade and the all-new SimMax and SimMax OS irons. With an improved speed bridge and echo damping system for better sound and forge-like feel, TaylorMade went further than even they thought possible to create a distance iron that feels better than anyone thought possible. Think about it. How many distance irons can say they have their own sound engineer? In fact, they sound and feel so good, some of the TaylorMade pros thought the irons were forged. The all-new SimMax and SimMax OS irons, designed for distance you can feel. Visit TaylorMadeGolf.ca to learn more about the all-new Sim family.
Before we wrap everything up, we got to hit the mailbag. So, Scotty, you open this up every single week. Questions flow in. What do we got this week?
Yeah, mailbag's been actually getting interesting. I mean, we mentioned France. You mentioned giving away your password, which could end up going out to a lot of people because apparently we have downloads in 60 countries now. So our questions are getting a little bit more diverse. They are coming in from different parts of the world now, which is great to see. Got a few questions here that I picked out. Let's start with, does it matter if...
Can you name six? Like, I might name 12 countries. Like, you know what I mean? That's insane. I just had to name it. Thank you to everyone. I think a quick thank you to those folks listening, because that's insane. 60 countries. Wow.
Yeah, we certainly didn't expect that when, you know, we got started with this project, but we're very appreciative, and it's nice to, you know, look into some charts and all of a sudden, you know, have people in Australia go, hey, my buddies listen to the podcast and I like it. And, you know, Netherlands and stuff like that. It's just, it's kind of surreal. And, you know, we're not sitting here tooting our horns. We're just happy that we're putting out something that people want to listen to and that they enjoy. So keep those mailbag questions questions coming in, you know, try and put them in English if you can. My Dutch is not that good, but if you have to and I have to get it interpreted, I'll go the extra mile to make that happen. So, all right, let's start with this. Does it matter if I play with different kinds of golf balls from what I practice with? You want to handle that one?
I mean, if you're able to practice with the same golf ball you play, you must be on the PGA Tour. I don't know where else you would, unless you're playing at like a super high-end golf club. I personally don't really care that much. It's around the putting green, and when I'm chipping, that's where, yeah, I try to use the same one just for just getting used to the spin on chip shots and stuff, because, you know, you might hit you hit one of those range balls and you try to hit those little spinners and it's not going to spin, and then you try that same shot and you're used to it running out and now it's stopping, you know, 20 feet short. So that's the main area, chipping, you know, putting still, you know, I'd recommend just for the feel wise, but on the range, take what you can get.
Yeah, I think you're bang on with that assessment. I mean, we're obviously not in a situation at most places where you can, you know, be like the PGA Tour and pick out what model of ball that you have. But, you know, that feel is really important. The way that golf ball is going to, you know, take off your putter. So, yeah, if you can chip and putt and not do it with range balls and do it with your own, that'll help you get a little bit more oriented as far as your game is concerned. So, all right, going to work our way down here. Now, we talk a lot on this podcast about equipment. We talk about older equipment. We've gone through a number of manufacturers and talked about older iron sets. This person had a question: is if I look to buy an older used forged set of irons, what should I do with them to make them more playable?
The first thing is definitely go to your local pro shop, your local golf shop, and just make sure you get the lies, the lofts. That's the first thing. You got to check those, like, because a lot of times, and this is almost a yearly thing I recommend with forged clubs, is getting them checked, because they can bend pretty quickly. And, you know, I actually remember a guy coming in, he hadn't got them checked in 10 years. His 9-iron was bent the same way as a pitching wedge. They were the exact same loft, which is, you know, you're playing worse when that's happening. So that's the first thing. Maybe you need some grips. But absolutely, go get those. Maybe you can't afford grips, those two should only cost you, you know, a little bit, and hopefully there's not that much to adjust. If the grips are fine, then you could probably go and play with them. Do you got anything else?
No, older sets are really serviceable. And I mean, some people shy away from them because they think somehow the technology is not any good. But you're right. I mean, you know, checking something like the lofts, the lies, the grips, obviously make sure they're fitted. I mean, you could, if you can, knowing that when you go to buy the set, that it's a shaft that's usable for you. And then, you know, that's maybe suitable. But really, you can buy some of the older sets and certainly make them serviceable and for less of an investment. But, you know, definitely work with a pro to kind of get your lofts and lies all sorted out. And like you said, I've seen that situation before where somebody will show up for a lesson and they'll say, oh, I hit my 8-iron and my 9-iron the same. Somehow they think it's them. And then all of a sudden you go and look and yeah, you're right. They're all of a sudden their lofts are plus or minus a half a degree within each other. All right. Someone had a little bit of a history question here. When did the Canadian amateur start and where? Do you want me to tackle that one? That's more my, and hold I wasn't on, there.
there goes my joke. Okay. Second joke. It started in Canada.
Oh, good call. Yeah. You got that one figured out.
There you go.
Canadian amateur was first played in 1895, believe it or not. It was right at the start of the formation of what was then the Canadian Golf Association, became the Royal Canadian Golf Association, Golf Canada, of course. And it was actually won by a guy from Kingston, believe it or not far from where we do this podcast. There used to be a golf course some miles from where I'm living, a little closer to where I am. And it was played, he was a member there, and he ended up going up to Ottawa, which is where they hosted it. They founded the Canadian Golf Association up there. And it started there in 1895.
Couple questions. Sure. Did you make the cut?
There was no cut. No cut. At okay, that
so
point.
So you made the cut. So,
and no, I was not there. I'll reiterate that again and again and again.
Second, what was this course called? I didn't know this.
Oh, the Kingston Golf Club?
Yeah, that's where. Yeah. Do you yeah. know, like, where was it? Like, where are we talking land point wise?
Where it was located was right where you would find the gymnasium for the RMC, the Royal Military College, and where their soccer dome is located now. That was used to be called the Berryfield Common, and it actually was a place where soldiers used to practice and do different things. And then the clubhouse was up on the hillside there. And that club was actually originally founded in 1886, and it was one of the first 10 that were among the charter to sign for the creation of the Canadian Golf Association in 1895. There you go. It disappeared about, it had kind of two lives, and then it disappeared for good, sort of heading towards the 1920s, and Cataraqui, which is the club across town from it, sort of came up and started in 1917, and it became popular over there. They really needed to use that common ground anyways for other things. And so that's the history of that golf course, where the first Canadian amateur champion came from.
Damn, you must have been doing good in this teaching of your daughter at home. I'm learning history here. This is great. This is awesome.
Yeah, it's part of the curriculum. So, all right, a couple more questions here. And this is obviously coming from a listener in Australia. And I will say, again, looking at some of those charts, we're actually doing okay in Australia. But this person asked, who are your favorite golfers from Australia?
I mean, if we don't give Cameron Davis our number one at this point. He's the only pro that's been on the podcast that's Australian, so he's got to be number one. His caddy, Andrew, is a good buddy of mine. We roomed together at the Greenbrier, and just an absolute beauty. So fellow Australian as well. So that number one, easily. Super tall kid too. I don't know why that makes him my favorite. And then
it's all about height?
Yeah, it's all about height for me, but really tall. I'm going down a dark path I shouldn't go. And then the next, Cameron Smith. This guy's hilarious. He's, you know, he made Patrick Reed angry. That's enough for me.
Good enough. I'll go with a little bit more of a classic golfers. Obviously, I'm a different era. Peter Thomson, one of the greatest players of all time, multiple time Open champion, certainly considered one of the greatest Australians, if not the greatest Australian player of all time. And Corey Webb. You know, we always think, and a lot of times you say great Australian players, a lot of people gravitate to the male side of the games. Corey was one of the first players that I interviewed as a journalist. She was a defending champion at what was then the Des Mauriers, which is obviously the CP Women's Open now. She won it in 99 at Prittis Greens out in Alberta. Did an interview with her soon after that, and she continued to be a great champion at golf, not only playing wise, but outside the golf course as well. And she's also been someone who's inspired a lot of other golfers, young golfers, and you know, provided scholarships and inspiration for the next generation, including Hannah Green, who won.
True.
The PGA.
We got to give Hannah Green some love too. Wait, is she Australian? Isn't she from New Zealand?
She is.
Oh, I should. Oh, that could get us in trouble.
Yeah, you could. So I think her caddy might not want to have us on here.
Yeah, anyway. Sidebar: can we just talk for a second about Des Mauriers sponsoring golf tournaments? Like usually the sponsors of the tournament hand out things. Like, were they handing out cigarettes back? Was this actually what happened back in the day?
Yeah. So, Peter Jackson, which is another cigarette company, used to be the sponsor of what was then the Canadian Tour. Yes, Des Mauriers, definitely. Cigarettes were available. Export A used to be a sponsor of the Skins game in Canada, which became the TELUS Skins game eventually. And I can certainly tell you when John Daly played in that, again, back in 99, I guess, at Mont Tremblant, one of the biggest things he was excited about was that he could get as many cigarettes as he wanted from Export A.
Fair enough.
History crazy again. To think about now. So obviously that cigarette, you know, money, the tobacco, big tobacco money went away, and you know, golf survived without them. So, all right, last one here. Which PGA Tour, and this is the question I was referencing to earlier, which PGA Tour player do you think would have the hardest time carrying their bag if they could not use a caddy? So you were talking about electric caddy.
Yeah.
What if they weren't able to use that at all and they had to carry their full staff bag?
Oh,
who do you think would struggle?
They have to carry the staff bag.
Holy. Yeah, imagine that. That might be fun just to watch.
Well, it might show what's actually necessary in the bag. You know what I mean?
True.
There's guys that carry, like I joke about Martin having like 10 things of sunscreen in there, you know, every time you open it up. But there's Martin has basically nothing in his golf bag. One of the lightest bags out there, and it's heavy enough. But there's probably guys with tons of stuff. I'm going Tiger Woods.
Tiger's
got a horrible back. Yeah, I bet you he has not carried a bag in 30 years.
Except for Charlie's, which I'm sure is a nice little light bag.
But
right?
Didn't he have the push cart on the range with him?
I think he probably did. Yeah. So you're right. So, you know, not on the back.
I got to go with Tiger. Maybe some of the heavier set lads out there are gonna struggle from a sweating point. so I'm thinking like I'm going Tiger or anybody with like kind of back issues. It's gonna suck. heavy guys, but also the really thin, skinny guys like Danny Lee. You think Danny Lee's like slugging a tour bag around? Ricky's not a big dude. You know, I think Ricky's fit though. He can make it work. But yeah, Tiger's my pick. I kind of like my follow up question after, but we'll let you answer. Who you think's gonna
I'm gonna go Kiradek Happy Barn Rat for sure. Even though he's proven he's a pretty good athlete, I really don't see him, you know, kind of hauling that bag around, he having his cigarettes going on. Speaking of cigarettes, and getting too far, especially if he had to play a golf course that's got some hills to it, that could be funny to watch. And you're right, even on the slimmer side, I mean, I don't see Webb Simpson, you know, hauling a bag around. Some of these guys, I who knows who's grown up carrying a bag? Maybe some guys would be comfortable with it. Maybe some guys are wiry, but that could be fun to see. That's for sure.
So with that though, we talked about earlier, like if guys were allowed different options and say a push cart or electric cart were an option, who do you think takes the electric cart?
Sungjae for sure. 100%. I mean, he's going to play 7,000 rounds as it is,
but the battery, the replacement batteries will be expensive.
Exactly. I mean, he's going to be going through them nonstop. So yeah, he'd probably be my guy for that.
Yeah. One. That's cool. I could see John Daly repping one, he's got the dart in one hand. He's pushing, got his hand, there's a little button thing or remote,
remote control.
Yeah. The remote control. You know, I don't want the PGA Tour to come back without caddies at all. You know, if there's like a fraternity, like I'm the guy at the door that, you know, they're pushing out the door as much. Like that's how little I'm hanging on. But like, I don't want these. They need to be out there. Golf would be a disaster without them at that level. There's so many guys that would struggle so hard without them. And we don't need to get too far down that. But if it did happen, though, this is the content I'm here for. And I would be, if I could find a website that had prop bets on this type of stuff, I might go broke. I'd have so much fun with that.
Well, I think that'd be more like the every player out there. And I think that would kind of, you know, make them a little bit more relatable. So I think it would be fun just to see, even for a tournament. I mean, you know, they eliminated having caddy races at Scottsdale, but, you know, it'd be funny to see cart races with some of these guys, especially even them just, you know, using the remotes. I mean, we could end up with carts in creeks and lakes, all sorts of different things. So
maybe they would allow actual carts again, just for like, till caddies come back. Pace of play would be fast because like they're getting to the ball quick enough. And if they for some reason go without caddies, I really hope they get creative. I hope they don't, but if they do, please get creative. Do a cart tournament, a carry tournament, a push cart tournament. Let's be fun with it. But I don't see it happening, and hopefully it doesn't. What I do see happening is golf coming up soon, as we talked about earlier. And if you want to be ready, you need to be listening to the Tip of the Week every single week. So, Scotty, here's your chance. It's your time to shine. What's the Tip of the Week before we wrap things up?
My Tip of the Week, I mean, yes, we're getting closer to obviously getting outside. A lot more people hitting some balls in nets. I don't want to be talking about putting and chipping all the time. So let's talk a little bit about the full swing. But one thing a lot of people got to think about is that intention is really important in your golf swing. A lot of people get up there and they're worried about where their elbow is going and what they're trying to do in their swing motion. But you got to figure out first what you're actually trying to accomplish. And, you know, if you slice or hook excessively, you know, you've got to understand why it happens. And it's not because there's magic fairy dust coming down and going to make you do one thing or the other. There's actually physics that are part of it. The golf ball only responds to one thing, and it responds to the club head, how it moves, where it's pointing. This is really, really important in the golf swing. So, and how you strike it as well, and where you strike it. These are all different factors that determine how that golf ball is going to fly. So it's really important that golfers really understand the root of all those things before they start making swing changes, because what they're going to do in their swing changes, you're trying to affect that relationship that your golf club has with the ball and what it's going to do. So, you know, talk to your coach, have them explain a little bit more in detail. It's worth your time. And I tell you what, if you know the intention of exactly what you're trying to do, of where the face needs to be pointed or how the club needs to be traveling as it comes through the golf ball, you're going to have a lot better idea of what you're trying to do to shape shots. And, you know, you also better understand your miss hits as well.
It's a great tip, and hopefully I can use that outside here soon. And I think it's any day now we're going to get some good news in Ontario, and to all the people golfing outside of Ontario, you know, we're jealous of you, and I hope you're having fun and taking it lightly and creating some memories, because that's the best part about golf, that we've talked about the stories and the laughs, and we're hoping we can do that here soon in Ontario. And hopefully by next week, we can talk about some positive news, and maybe we'll even have played by then. Who knows? Who knows at this point? But until then, thank you for listening. Make sure you subscribe. Make sure you rate us 5 stars. Tell your friends. We maybe 61 countries next week if you tell your friends. Maybe you got a friend in a weird country we haven't heard about, because I couldn't name 60, let alone 61. I'm just rambling now. We got to wrap this up. Thank you for listening, everyone. We'll see you next week.
Like today, my boat's lost in the ocean.